All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Meaning of the Unknowing Minds podcast. It is exciting to have you back. We've got a great show lined up for you, but it is incredible to be here. Episode number 15, making this a special one. No questions about that. But as always, please pull a chair up to the table, pop a top, open up the can of water or the can of water. Wow, if you got a can of water, let me know where you found that thing. But open up a soda, pour some sweet tea with a little lemon in there. Whatever the case, I like my sweet tea with lemon. Get some Aquafina going. Whatever the case might be, some juice. Pour another coffee. Put another pot on, whatever the case might be, whatever you're drinking with us, or if you're out walking around, running around, we appreciate you joining us. But once again, for the 15th episode of the Meeting of the Unknown Minds podcast, got to share, we're excited because the amount of listening we've done, or listeners we've had, and downloads we've had, we're up in the top 35 in the country of running podcasts. We're trying to make an impact, and that's the hope that we do with this. So we are excited to have everybody here. And tonight, again, today's is special. It's another Hall of Famer. It's another gentleman who's done some incredible things in the sport. We're going to get to him in a second. But as always, my name is Matt Eschy, the head cross country coach, associate head track and field coach at UAB. Again, thank you for being here. First and foremost, we've got him back. He's had a couple week hiatus. It's great to have him here. The Jumps Multis coach at VCU, Tom Sage. Tom, how are we doing, sir?
Doing well. I'm excited for this one.
I hope so. If you're not, I don't know what's wrong with you, man. I tell you what. Guy who is tired after just walking down 100 meters out there in Nevada, Mr. Scott Williamson. Scott, how you doing?
You know, I'm making it. I tell you, you have a few months off from doing some coaching. You forget how much work it is to be out there all day. So I'm alive and kicking, so happy to be here.
It's great to have you here. Glad you guys were able to practice, especially with everything you got going on. We got the gentleman who makes us all sound good, makes us all, we'd say, look good if we were around him, but definitely makes us sound good and cleans things up. Down in the Rio Grande Valley, apparently it was a nice, cool 57. He didn't use the word cold earlier, so I appreciate that. But after the beard, Mr. Darren Flowers, how we doing, sir?
Doing good, man. Watching my kids sprint across the backyard. Forms, we got to get to work. May I ask Leroy for some pointers here.
We've got one of the best in the country, if not one of the best in the world, on here tonight. No questions about that. We've got he decided to finally take a day off of coaching, just do some stuff in the office, which actually sometimes is harder than doing stuff outside of coaching. No questions about that. The director of track and field at St. Louis and cross country, excuse me, Mr. John Bell. Sir, how are we doing?
Doing well. It's needed a day off. You know, 10 hours on the track yesterday. And unlike Scott, we're in our fourth week of practice. You know, our semester's half over. So needed a little break today, so stayed at home.
Questions about that. And as always, the most unsophisticated gentleman that does a great job looking like he's absolutely sophisticated. He just keeps the hair curled to make everything go well. The Jumps coach out of Indiana University in the Hoosier State, Mr. Mike Erb. How we doing, sir?
I'm doing great. You figured it out. It's all smoke and mirrors over here. So keep that a secret. Well, good thing there's no video.
Man, good thing we didn't hit record on this one, and there's only, you know, 15 of these beforehand, so you never know what happens. It just took me that long to figure this one out. Yeah. And as always, we saved the best for last. No questions about that. I think you guys have all seen the picture on it, on who we've got today, but he's a graduate of Houston back in 1991. He was an All-American in the 100 and long jump, NCAA runner-up in the long jump as well, NCAA champ in 89. World record holder, former world record holder in the 4x2, 1990. He was a Jumbo Elliott Award winner for the nation's top track and field athlete as well. Competed in the Goodwill Games. I'm going through stuff fast because I think we could write a book on what this gentleman has accomplished as well. The top rated sprinter in the world from 90 to 91, and if I'm not mistaken, only lost two races during that time in the 100. Ran in the Olympics in 92 and 96. He was fifth in the 1992 100, but at the same time, I believe Coach, remind me, was it a gold medal in the 4x1 that year, 92?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Was it a world record as well, or was it just a gold medal?
Both.
Okay. I apologize for not knowing that.
But at least that's okay. It's okay. You know, Hey, one thing most people in a situation like this will tell you, keep it short. I can't live up to that anymore. So one thing
I definitely wanted to hit on this was the 1994 record holder in 985. Definitely something I had on that thing before I turned it over. You've been at Houston for 22 years, multiple time Coach of the Year, not only in the Southwest Conference, which is now the Conference USA for those coach for those people who don't know it, but with the American Athletic Conference as well. We could go on and on, but we won't. So, but we've got the the president of the USTFCCA. There we go. Sorry, we'll leave that right there, Mr. Leroy Braille. But Leroy, it is great to have you here, sir.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here, and you know, I'm really looking forward to a good you know, couple of hours talking track and field and you know, the sport we love, and how we're all trying to you know manage through some really challenging times. So no, I'm really excited and looking forward to it.
No, absolutely. Again, it is, it's an honor to have you. No questions about that. The so how, I mean, I think the easiest question first and foremost, how did you get to UH?
I mean, as a student athlete?
Yeah, let's start there.
Well,
yes.
Well, gosh, you know, man, that was a long time ago, but this is, this is the story. A lot of people don't really know this story, but, I grew up in right outside of Philadelphia, in Lansdowne, little town, not too far from the Philadelphia International Airport. And I ran at Penwood High School there. But at that time, Carl Lewis's mom and dad were still coaching high school track in Willingboro, New Jersey, which is about 15 miles or so northeast from the Philadelphia area. And Philly's a pretty really good track city. And you know, there's a lot of good information, a lot of real, you know, colorful coaches, and then of course you got the Penn Relays as well. But they published the Coaches Association in the area published you know a top list. And my senior year in high school, I was at one point I think ranked number one in the, I think we ran the 55, the 300 long jump and triple jump. Yep. And so Miss Lewis, Evelyn Lewis, Carl's mom, yep. Called coach and said, "Hey, there's this kid you know, over on the Philadelphia side of the river who's kind of leading the nation. I think I might have been leading the nation in a couple of those events, you know. And you might want to give him a call." So, Coach Tellez just out of the blue. Tom Tellez, my predecessor at Houston and former coach, you know, called my high school coach out of the blue and said, "Hey, we'd like to have you come down for a visit." Like, he didn't, and it was kind of a no brainer because you know, that was in 1985, the fall, pretty much the year after Carl won four gold medals in the games, and so. Actually, I'm sorry, that was 1984 because I graduated in 85. So a few months before that. Okay, there you go. Yep. And I was like, sure, I'd love to go. And I took a visit and you know they were pretty smart about it. You know, I came down and visited Houston in I think like early March, maybe early March. And
nice right then.
Not to mention the fact that and no disrespect to the Big Ten, but I'd taken a visit over spring break at Ohio State and went from Columbus to Houston in early March. It was the hard decision. you couple that with during the visit, you know, I happened to I met you know my childhood idol Carl Lewis. I mean, and he pulled up in a bright red Porsche and had pulled up to the track practice in a bright red Porsche in a 85 maybe 75 degree day in March with a cell phone, and it was the coolest thing. It was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. Well, you know, it wasn't really a cell phone. It was really more like a briefcase. but he was on the phone walking around track practice. And I was like, oh, my God. What is that? That is some James Bond stuff right there, man. And so I was like, well, this place is awesome. This is where I need to come. So signed with Houston and never look back.
Man. That would definitely be some James Bond. blown up with the kind of a thing, the phone. Holy cow. Does that mean, yeah, I mean, you don't have to deal with the snow in Columbus, Ohio. You don't have to deal with the cold. It's probably still bitter cold up there as it is right now. It probably hasn't thawed out. No questions about that.
Well, I'm going to give you some recruiting ammunition there for Ohio State. Cause now when I went to Ohio State, I was trying to, do the right thing. It's over spring break. I'm going to try to get a workout in.
Yep.
And they told me that, in order to use our facilities, you have to wear one of our practice uniforms. And I'm like, okay. So they gave me a practice uniform. I guess it's a Big Ten thing. I don't know, but
I don't know.
Might have been. So, yeah.
So they gave me a strap with the practice uniform that I think Jesse Owens may have worn. How old it was. That thing was the rattiest piece of material I think I'd ever worn. And I'm thinking, oh my God, this is ridiculous. Yeah. And then I'm kind of walking around Ohio Stadium. It's pretty cool going to the facility, and I'm looking at the record boards. And I'm like, man, Jesse Owens still has school records here. Jeez, I mean, this is 1985. You know? Yeah. So I was thinking, that's a problem. You know, Jesse, no doubt, Jesse's an amazing, 4 gold medals in his own right, our greatest track and field athlete of all time, half a century. Yeah. And, but goodness gracious, I mean, nobody came to Ohio State in 55 years to be able to eclipse any of his records. So I was like, and then you go to Houston, you see the modern day Jesse Owens, who has driving a Porsche and has a cell phone. And
it's a no-brainer.
To be fair, I don't think some of those records that Jesse Owens got broken until the last maybe decade or so. I mean, they were there till there's still some Big Ten records hanging out that I'd seen.
From what I understand, that's certainly the case. And so, but it was, no doubt. I enjoyed the time I visited Ohio State, but it was just really, at the time Houston was in the Southwest Conference.
Yep.
The Southwest Conference had, University of Texas, Texas A&M, Arkansas, Baylor. Yeah, it was a pretty salty Houston, Rice, Texas Tech. It was a really salty conference. And, then you couple that, the weather, the coaching acumen, U of H has pretty solid facilities. So it was a great situation for me, and coming from the city, I grew up in the suburbs, but I was really a city kid. Move to a city like Houston, in the 80s, when basically everything here was brand new, it was really, really easy. I've made it my home, and Houston's been very good to me.
It's been absolutely good to you. There are questions about that. You take over at Houston in what would it be, about 89-ish? 89.
Mm-hmm. 99.
I'm sorry. I'm looking at the statistics I wrote down and realized 89 would not have made sense at all. Take over in 99. What was your – I mean, it's already still a great – it's a very, very solid track and field program. Not the heights that you have it at right now. It is a phenomenal, phenomenal level right now. Mm. What was the goal when you arrived there? Was it to get to this or get to it quicker, or was it just, what was your goal?
Well, oddly enough, as an alum, my goal, I mean, the performance, I wasn't necessarily all that worried about the performance side of things. The thing that I was most disappointed about the time that I was there and some of the things that happened during my time as a pro there was, a lot of kids weren't finishing school, and some institutional issues, I guess it was some cultural problems, and so my goal was I didn't want that to continue to happen. And so we wanted to, I wanted to come in and really just build a, more of an academic culture, have the kids take the student portion of their title of a student athlete much more seriously. and finish school, because you know it's really difficult to sustain the excellence of a program on pure performance alone. You know, usually it leads to something that you don't always, you're not always proud of, we've done some really, really good things as student athletes, but we just weren't getting it done academically. And so we weren't getting it done academically. So that was one of the main things I wanted to see happen. At the time we were in Conference USA, yep. which for us, for our institution, in reality was really somewhat disappointing. We felt like as an institution, as a department, that our record merited more than that. The University of Houston basketball team played in three Final Fours, and lost on the last second buzzer shot that still haunts us. played in several Cotton Bowls and been ranked in the top 10 several times, and our baseball team took cross country. A lot of people don't realize it, but the University of Houston won a national championship in cross country.
Yeah.
Believe it or not. So our golf team, our golf program, it won 16 national championships. And so to get left out of the expansion or creation of the Big 12 was really, really disappointing. I mean, it was an unbelievable institutional gut punch. Yeah. Took several years for us to kind of get out of that. And so our department had reached some really, really lows. And this was just coming off of building a $25 million indoor practice facility and track and weight room with all the bells and whistles, basically what everybody else is building now. And then to find ourselves in Conference USA, no disrespect to any of those institutions, it just felt like it was a really difficult situation. And so for our track program, though, it was great because we were pretty much the only fully funded program in the league, and we were the only one that had seriously adequate facilities and a coaching staff with the pedigree that had really competed in at a very, very high level, produced teams that competed at a very, very high level. So, we won quite a few championships, and actually we even managed to pull out a cross-country championship in that league, which is something that I'm actually one of the more proud moments of my coaching career. We just kind of were rattling them off, and it was I wouldn't say it was easy because, we had a nice formula, but we were rattling them off, and then the track program started to slip a little bit as well, because we just couldn't attract that high level talent. And so then we started to kind of broaden it out and just kind of depth people to death, I guess you'd say. And
you can do that. Yeah.
Then we kind of managed to get it back, and in the process, I had to make some changes to the coaching staff. Some of the coaching staff that held over from Tom's era. I had to, kind of gracefully usher them out of the program, and then bring in some new blood. And then boom, we get invited to join the Big East, and then boom, that falls apart like 10 weeks later. I mean, 10 weeks, like 10 days later. And I'm right about that, John. That was about 10 days. So then the Big East kind of reconstitutes itself as the American Athletic Conference. But, we go into that league, and you got, the likes of the University of Connecticut, who pretty much dominated the Big East I want to say maybe I better be a little bit more judicious there. We're very, very a big force in the Big East. And, we had to kind of reimagine ourselves. And, and we went through that process, and we felt like we needed to kind of develop some 800 meter runners and do a little bit more work in the field. And so we we just kind of were kind of hanging around. And then, we were able to catch lightning in a bottle back about 6 years ago. My son decided to come to Houston. Yep. And then he attracted Eli Hall and Amir Ladin and Trumaine Jefferson then Kamari Montgomery and Obi Okwue decided to transfer, and all of these things started happening. And before we knew it, we found ourselves in a pretty solid position to be able to contend for national championships. And I really do feel that we blew it for 2 years, but that's how it goes. So, it's been really good. I tell people all the time, people always say, man, you guys got that program. You guys really got it there. And then you guys have blown up. No, we didn't blow up. No, we kind of smoldered for a long time. There was like a lot of smoke, and then we're out there. And then finally, we were able to get things going, and we're really excited about where we are. But we got a lot more to do, and our goals are the same, and it's even more difficult now because it's like you can't sneak up on anybody now. And we're probably doing it with half the money of those who are able to do it on an annual basis are doing it. So that's what we do.
That's what you guys do. And you guys have done a tremendous job. I know they did a little, I'll leave my feelings out from this FloTrack side, but FloTrack did the speed season following you guys, which was, honestly, it was awesome. I don't know actually it was more awesome than that or watching Carlos's face every once in a while.
Yeah, Carl's a piece of work, man. He is who he is. I thought that was really interesting too, because if you probably should ask Carl to be on. I should call him and tell him to join us, but
go ahead.
Carl and I, of course, Carl and I, we've kind of gone through the whole gamut. I came to Houston because he was my idol. And then when I got here, I started performing and I learned. I mean, I was, I soaked everything in and fortunately I had the talent and performed really, really well as a freshman. But then I got hurt. I tore my ACL at the end of my freshman year at the Southwest Conference meet. And then it was a long road back. And so Carl went from a mentor and then kind of like a brother. He kind of took me under his wing big time and kind of showed me the ropes and how to kind of basically help me get up off the mat. And then it was like, then one day, I decided to run U.S. Nationals actually on our track in Houston and ran 994 and almost broke the world record as a junior in college. And then it was like, oh, wait a minute, this guy, hold on now. it's really interesting. I have a picture in my office. I'm at home now, but I have a picture in my office at work my freshman year. And actually I have two pictures. One is a picture of me on the on the medal stand at the NCAA indoor meet where Lee McRae broke the world record in the 55, and I placed third as a freshman. And I'm on the stand, and I am pissed. I am like, I've got my little, I think that the plaque's right behind me. I've got that in my hand. I'm like,
I don't like this.
Yep. And so the week later, they have a pretty big meet. Really, a lot of people don't really. It really flies under the radar, but a really big, great high school meet at Texas Southern University called the TSU Relays. and I ran the 100 there. I mean, I'm fresh off, NC's that Saturday, Saturday, I'm running the 100. And I was actually leading Carl at about 60 meters, and Carl did Carl things, and he passed me. And I'm in, and there's a picture of me as we're crossing the finish line, and I'm looking over at him the same way. And at 19, I was like, hey, I want to beat him. Another guy on the line. you know, and I pretty much always handled it that way. But, you know, we've kind of gone through the whole thing, the competitors, and then, you know, Carl, several years on the circuit, and we're going back and forth and trading the world record and all that stuff. And then Carl decides he's going to retire. And I kind of hang around a little bit longer, and then I retire. And right, but before I retired, he's like, "Hey, you need to coach." And I'm like, "No, I don't." And he's like, "No, you need to, you ought to go and coach. Coach T wants to retire, and he wants you to be the coach, so you need to coach." And I'm like, "No, I don't." I was planning my retirement, so I had taken the LSAT, and I I'm sorry, my mom's calling me. I'm going to have to call her back a little later. I'd taken the LSAT, and I applied and was admitted to law school. As a matter of fact, I was admitted to the University of Indiana.
Oh, is that right?
They offered me a scholarship, as a matter of fact.
It looked a whole lot different up here, yeah.
That's what I was going to do. I wanted to be a lawyer. I wanted to make some money. I wanted to have some, you know, do all of that. But he and Coach T kind of cornered me in the office one day, and they're like, "No, you need to coach. You need to take the job." I was like, first of all, Coach T, you can't hire me. You're like, the AD has to hire me. And like, I volunteered, mm-hmm. just so I can kind of go with you guys sometimes and not have to pay for it, you know? But I wasn't really coaching. And so he's like, "No, you can do it. You're the biggest track rat out here, man. You're the one hanging around, and you watch us coach the ball, watch us do it. You're the only guy, you're like a track guy. You're always there. You're always in the office. You can do it. And plus, you keep let the assistants do all the work, and you just kind of keep it going." I'm like, so anyway, they tell me, okay, I ask my wife, and she says, "Well, you know, I mean, it is kind of what you do, and you know, I can't imagine it would be that difficult." So
why would it be?
and she says, "You know, I mean, you won't have to worry about looking for a job." So she talks me into it, and then I go and talk with the senior woman administrator at U of H at the time, and you know, told her, "Hey, I'd be interested in doing it." And then it was just a matter of selling it to the AD, who was at the time was Chet Glatchuk, who's at the current AD at the Naval Academy. And so he brought me in the office and asked me a gazillion questions, and you know, this is the funny part of the story, really, really funny part of the story. I made a resume, but like all the jobs I had were jobs that I created, you know. I own a couple real estate, I own a couple of properties, so I was like a real estate developer, and you know. I was investing in the stock market, so I was a, you know, investor. and they said, "Okay, cool." Now, nowadays, like, they really kind of vet that out, and like, never would get the job. But, I guess I convinced them that I wouldn't screw it up so badly, and they gave me a shot. And I'll tell you this, when my first day at Houston, July 1st, as a head coach at the University of Houston, July 1st, 1999, I walked into Coach Tillett's office. There was no computer. There was a Rolodex. Remember Rolodex? There was a Rolodex. There was a couple of stacks of some questionnaires a couple of kids had filled out. Actually, I think we only had one computer in the track program. At the time, and it was an old, like,
big old box,
big old Apple computer, like, yeah. And I'm like, I had got better stuff at home, so I bought my stuff from home to the office, and I basically bought my home office to my work office, and started working, and you know, it was really interesting the first year. It was a really, really, really strange, you know, but got through it. I don't remember much of it, but I just remember thinking, "God, this is what the hell is going on here?" You know, And slowly but surely, we were able to get a few things here and there and make it work. It wasn't easy, but we got it done.
I got a quick question. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, I was just curious. Obviously, the influence of Coach Chelez on you as an athlete was significant. We could see that on the track. How did that transition go, and what kind of influence, in relationship did you maintain during, especially the beginning of your coaching career? What did he teach you as a coach beyond just the athletic part of it?
Well, a lot. I knew what our program was like. I knew what our training plan was, but I actually knew it so well, in fact, that I knew where our weaknesses were. I knew some of the things that we needed to do I want to be real careful about this. Okay. But if we had kind of innovated and evolved a little bit with our program, I really do think that U of H could have and should have won several national championships. We were kind of living on our past a bit and investing in one or two, all of our effort in one or two athletes, when I really do think that we could have broadened it and recruited anywhere we want. Tom could have gone in anybody's house. Mm-hmm. And he could have probably swept the whole Caribbean clean, but he just chose not to. And we probably could have done a lot more with with the things that were being that we were producing, and with the results that were being produced here. So I kind of knew that, and I felt like we needed to develop more of a team concept. And I told Coach early on that, I'm not him. I had to basically let him know that I'm not him, and I can't do it his way. And that was difficult, because he coached here for well over, I think, 22 years himself. And they had Mike Caja and Howie Ryan and Kyle Telez, the rest of the staff, Teresa Fuqua, had their way of doing things, and I was trying to change and evolve and grow. So that was challenging. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, we were left with a couple of really, really good athletes. Vanetta Roll, who was an All-American in the 800, and Jenny Adams, who was NCAA champion, a two-time NCAA champion, long jump, and finalist in the hurdles. John Davis, who was an NCAA finalist in the shot put. Who else? Dennis Darling, who was an NCAA finalist in the 400. And Kareem Olsen, I think he was a 148 half mile. So we had really good athletes in the program coming out. Wow. And I'll never forget, the first team meeting. First of all, we actually had a team meeting. When I was in Houston, we had one team meeting a year, and that was the beginning of the year. This is what we're going to do. These are rules. That's it. We're done. Go. We're at practice. See you there.
Wow.
Well, I came in. We have a team meeting every week, and we have a staff meeting every week. And they're like, why are we having all these meetings? I said, so we can all be on the same page. I remember we were going to break from one of the meetings. We're going to break. And they're like, what do you mean, Coach? I said, we're going to break. We're going to do something. We're going to have something that we say as a team that kind of unifies us. And then we're going to go do our work. And they're like, who's this dude? It's like last year you were like you were the elite athlete who trains on a track. And this year you're like trying to change everything. I'm like, well, now that's just me. My high school program was like that. And we had a team type concept, and I wanted to develop a team concept for whatever I was going to be in charge of. And so that's what we did. And I think early on with the coaching staff, it kind of came across as hokey because it's something that we never did. And so they were all looking around like, what was this too? So, but that's what we did. A program has to, I think, a leader has to lead a program the way he wants to be led, and run it the way he wants to be run. I can't try to be Tom Telez because I'm not Tom Telez. And so, that's what we've been able to do. And in the process, I think over the 22 years, we built a really, really solid culture. And our kids do now, you know, fight for each other, and they run for each other. They're really at it. And we've had some really amazing moments where guys have taken things, and women as well, taking it to another level because they wanted to do it for the team, you know? And so, and I think that's one of the hallmarks for what we do. You know, I mean, one of the proudest things one of my proudest accomplishments, it might not seem like much to many, but you know, we're like the only team that has gone in to the Gillum Fieldhouse at A&M and beaten them. You know how hard that is to do? I mean, and you know who hasn't been able to do it? Florida hasn't. Texas hasn't. You know, Texas Tech hasn't. You know, Arkansas hasn't.
Yep.
But we have. And I'm really proud of that. You know? And I hope they don't put that on their bulletin board.
Do we need to edit that out?
Yeah.
No, that's a good thing.
Well, I do have a question. I got a question for you. You know, how long did you feel like it took for you in your early coaching days to feel that kind of cultural shift, you know, that more of a team camaraderie? How long was that process like for you? When did you feel comfortable with that?
It took a really long time for me to feel like we were that cohesive. And actually, we were able to win without being a very strong team for a long, long time, just because of our situation. You know, we had some inherent, you know, advantages, or recruiting advantages, facilities advantages, and, you know, I don't think we really turned the corner and created the team, started really building the team culture we wanted to until we actually got beat. We got beat at a couple of times, actually. But one that really stands out is we lost the conference championship one of the last couple of years in the Conference USA at Rice. And it was really because we just weren't a very good team. We had the talent, but we just weren't a group of guys, group of women who are really gonna fight for each other. And it was kind of embarrassing. I think it was embarrassing to the guys, you know, and slowly but surely more guys started to wake up and realize that we had to be a better group to get it done. We actually lost to Memphis, and the guys were like, you might want to edit that out too. but we lost to Memphis, and the guys are like, can't believe we lost to Memphis. I'm like, well, they beat us. You know, they came to play and you guys didn't. So
yeah, sometimes a kick in the pants, you know, it's all you need.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you've changed things around, you've changed cultures around and all that kind of, you know, you've done it with tremendous job. Very focused on what you're going to do. And again, the men and women at Houston are doing are rocking and rolling, and they're not letting anybody beat them. I mean, again, you go into A&M and you beat A&M. That's a feather in the cap, no matter what.
We got a little work to do on the women, because, you know, we actually get it handed to us regularly there. But I think we're getting closer there as well. I think the women's situation, it's so much harder. It's kind of funny because I think it's hard. I think it's easier to coach women, because with women, if all else fails, you can take a guy and train a guy with a woman, all right? And that'll give them, you know, kind of push and develop some of the competitiveness that you want to see, you know, in that situation. You know, but it is so much more difficult to recruit and retain and build talent on the women's side. One, the scholarships are all out of whack, and there's so many more scholarships, and you know, and so you got all these people who really don't deserve. Gosh, I'm going to get myself in trouble. You got a lot of people on a lot of money who just don't perform, and there's really not much you can do, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's really tough. Whereas the guys, they're all scrapping and fighting, and I mean, they're really climbing all over each other, trying to get some attention. But at the same time, if you can build a culture with women, and they'll recruit guys for you, you know.
Oh, for sure. And, I mean, I've been a part of a program at VCU on the women's side that has won you know, six championships in the last 6 years or something like that. And they've actually helped bring guys in, mm-hmm. And have moved our guys up the, up the, their game and moved them up the ladder.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. So it's really tough, you know, and sometimes you wonder, man, what could you do if you only had to focus on one gender? But at the same time, it really just amazes me, you know, the coach that have been able to, you know, to do it, you know, and get it done on both sides. You know, one of the biggest, one of my best friends and a big mentor of mine who was actually at Houston, Vince Anderson, you know, won a national championship with men at the University of Tennessee, and actually went to Tennessee as a women's coach from Houston, as a matter of fact, with Dorothy Doolittle. And then moved to A&M, moved to the men's program, and won a national championship, two national championships there, then moved to A&M and won several on both sides. And so, I mean, he's just an amazing guy. And the other guys have been able to do it. Of course, Pat Henry, who's, you know, can somehow, some way keep them both going at the same time.
That's impressive.
Dennis Shaver, who's been able to do it on both sides. It's just really amazing. But it takes an unbelievable amount of skill, you know, to be able to manage all of those people to accomplish a goal.
Yeah, no questions about that. And being able to unite people is is something that's incredible and very, very hard to do. You're now I'm going to parlay that a little bit. You're now being the president of the Coaches Association, the USTF-CCCA. Mm-hmm. I'm trying not to get you in as much trouble, you know, as before a little bit.
Well, it's kind of funny because you remember those the Bugs Bunny cartoons when they said, hey, we need some volunteers, right? And everybody stepped back, and you're like, well, wait a minute.
Remember these, yes.
So I kind of feel a little bit, I kind of in that situation. You know, sometimes I think this is great. You know, I can really, really, make a difference and work to change and grow and make the sport a little bit better and leave something better than I found it. But then at the on the flip side, I'm like, gosh, this is taking a lot of time away from the stuff that I need to do here, you know, with my squad and then with my family. It's just a wonderful opportunity. And I kind of look at it like this. When I first started, a lot like when I first started in the office, when I went to my first convention, I'm like, what the heck are we doing?
Yeah.
The first convention I went to, I think it was in Orlando, and that was at the time when the Coaches Association had the convention at the same time as USA Track and Field. Yep. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, I'm looking at this and I'm like, well, first of all, you know, they're mostly college coaches here, but USA Track and Field has nothing here for us.
Yes.
We're doing this, you know, and then we're like doing little things at odd times, and then I'm going to the meetings and we're all, it's like 400 coaches in a meeting and we're arguing about rules. Like, I'm going to say this what the fuck are we doing? Mm-hmm. I'm literally like, why are we arguing about rules? I'm like, and at the time I saw my first Houston contract, I think I made $60,000 that first year. And I'm thinking, I made $60,000 in a race. Why are we not talking about the salary? You know? I didn't get it. And for about 3-4 years, I didn't get it, but I feel like I have to go because it's a coaches meeting. And even now, sometimes I still don't always get it because we argue about the things that get five nerds in the room and figure out how you want to conduct the jump competition and, you know,
come back and let us know.
Yeah, exactly. Tell us what we're going to do. If you tell me the rules, I'll go try to figure out how to win. You know, mm-hmm. I want to know why do we only have 12.6 scholarships? We need to work on that. You know, I want to know why we're counted as six sports, but we don't get six paychecks, you know? And why, you know, if you try to negotiate your contract, your AD looks at you like you have two heads. Okay. So I'm like, what? you know, if you go in and you try, hey, look, can we talk about this? Well, no, this is what we're going to offer you. Okay. How come we can't talk about it?
Yep.
Because you know, that's what we're talking about. Like, you negotiated your contract, didn't you? Yeah.
So, Leroy, I've got a question for you because we've talked about this a little bit on previous podcasts, but do you think now more than ever is a time where we make that shift for those conversations to be towards those bigger issues and stop, you know, nitpicking about some of this other stuff that we talk about at convention and amongst coaches?
Yeah, I think so. But unfortunately, you know, right now we're fighting for survival. You know, and so we got to put ourselves on stable ground, you know, and then I think we can start to, you know, worry about, you know, some of the other things. I mean, when we're losing programs, you know, and I don't know, maybe contraction's a good thing. You know, in business sometimes contraction's a good thing, but you know, it's just hard to see. It's hard enough to get a job, you know, nowadays.
Very much.
And if you get a gosh, I feel like this is going to be one of those things. Like, what's that movie? You know, the movie with Tom Cruise when he's an agent and he has like this epiphany and
Jerry Maguire.
Who's coming with me?
Yeah, exactly. Who's coming with me? I feel like this might be one of those situations. We need, in my opinion, and this is something that I really want to consider, we need to change, and I have talked to the Coach Association about this. The Coach Association right now is a program-based membership, and it should be an individual membership. Because if it's going to be about coaches and coaches' salary and coaches' well-being and, you know, and improving the lot of coaches, then coaches need to pay the membership, not the institutions, right? Problem is, you know, there are a lot of coaches who make very little or even pay to go to work, you know. That's what I see our problem is, that we are institutional based membership when we really need to be an individual based membership, and we need to go to the coaches convention as an individual to learn, you know, to work on how we build the profession of track and field coaching to the point where it's more respected and it's a bigger earning opportunity for the people involved.
I 100% agree with you on that, and it's interesting nowadays because we're trying to figure out, again, I think you said it back a second or two ago, we're in survival mode.
Mm-hmm.
About that, we got to make sure it is one of the things. What would you, because, you know, we're very, very fortunate to have, you know, Vinland Anna on a couple of weeks ago, talking about Gary Wilson last week, talking about the program. Both had talked about a little bit of elevator speeches. And we'll come back to the individual-based stuff in a second, but one thing I want to hit, is there something you tell track coaches, cross-country coaches right now and say, hey, be ready for this, or this is my now in the climate and the culture that we're all working and living in?
Well, you know, I mean, Ben and I were on a call about 3 weeks ago after the situation with the University of Minnesota came to light.
Yep.
I was on a call with Vin, Sam, Carl, and Mike Holloway.
Okay.
And we were kind of just basically chatting about what are we going to do here? I mean, this is crazy. I mean, how does the University of Minnesota that, you know, has a $75 million athletics budget and, you know, get to a point where they have, I think it was a $72 million deficit. And the decision is to cut the track and field program that costs, you know, $750,000 to run. It's like, how much money are you really saving? You know, you half the kids are paying their own way. God damn, it doesn't make any sense, you know? And so actually that's what spawned that letter that I wrote. And then started to, you know, tweet, and Sam started to tweet. Carl started to tweet. And one of the things that came out of that is, you know, we need some lawyers and lobbyists, and we really need to, you know, this is a political issue that we really have to kind of get after. But I guess to circle around and answer your question, you know, I hear that a lot. I mean, I've been to the convention many, many years, and you hear a lot of people say, you got to have your elevator speech ready. Well, I'm sorry, but why the fuck we got to get in the elevator? You know, why can't I just go down the hall and talk to my AD? You know, I'm like, come on, why can't we just have a decent conversation every once in a while about what we're going to do about our sport? Why do I got to wait until I can talk to my AD to cram something in? You know, I'm sorry. So to me, that, like, I get the idea, but, there are, an athletics department has, I don't know, 14, actually that's a lie, we don't have 14, maybe about 10 head coaches. You know, in some places they have a lot of sports, have even more. But yep. We're supposed to be the generals on our campus. Now we're not all 5-star generals. Well, actually, they don't even have 5-star generals anymore. You know, we're not all 4-star generals. You know, but I mean, even if I'm a 1-star general, goddamn, I'm a general. Shit, I should be able to talk to the commander in chief every once in a while. You know, and so to me, I think we just gotta be able to communicate anytime, not just have, you know, 5 minutes to cram it in, you know, because you know what, when you're cramming it in, nobody's really listening anyway. No. So it needs to be an ongoing dialogue. And so I'm really fortunate, you know, at least right now that my athletics director was here as an operations guy back when I first started. And so we kind of, you know, went up together, but at the same time, there's some times I'm like, Jesus, you know, because he's an AD, but I understand his job and I think he understands mine. And so I don't do elevator speeches. I call him and say, hey, this is what I'm thinking. And then he calls me and says, hey, what do you think about that? No, you got to get to the point where you can do that. And here's the other thing. Maybe ADs aren't always involved in who does the search for a track and field coach. But man, for crying out loud, if you get a job at a place and you don't establish a relationship with the AD right off the bat, you know, you just got hired and you don't establish that relationship, you're putting yourself in a bad position. And you got to take advantage of that while you can. And I know there aren't that many jobs to turn over, but I mean, if I'm going to get a job somewhere and move someplace, then I'm going to make sure that I have access. You know, I'm gonna make it a point that I have access, you know, and that's gonna be something that I'm gonna need to establish from day one, you know. But you can't, you know, sit in your office all day and then expect to wait until I can get in the hallway. Let me figure out a chance meeting so I can tell them how important track and field is. Well, you're not doing your job.
Yeah.
You're not doing your job. It's as simple as that. You know, and even I mean, I've gone through who knows 6 ADs here. You know, and I think I could go into any of their offices, you know, and you know, maybe I'm lucky, you know, but you know, I could always do that. And I didn't always choose to, but I knew I could. And I just made that happen. But, you know, that's just the way I've always tried to do things. And, you know, who knows? I've been lucky, but, you know, I've also only have had one job. And at a certain point when you've been somewhere as long as I have, you know, you get a little bit of a don't mess with the guy kind of. you get a little insulation there, and you know, but I don't know. It'd be interesting. I guess that's something maybe I need to think about. Do I need to try to go get another job somewhere? So,
I said this last week with Barry that I think, and I hate blaming coaches, but I think we're, especially track coaches, but I think we're really bad at this of just going and talking to people. You know, we are so busy with cross country in the fall and indoor during the winter and then outdoor in the spring that we just hunker down in our office and we never come out. Mm-hmm. And you have to go out and see people. You have to be active in your department. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one thing I took away from our conversation last week with Gary. Is just going again, you don't need to cram and there's no way to cram three seasons of information and a story about 72 track kids, you know, to your AD in 10 minutes. It's just, it's not possible. It's a long conversation if you want to, you know, to have any meaning, you know, behind it. So I think going out and actually, you know, that's my piece of advice to all coaches is go out and talk to the people in your department, talk to your sports, you know, your sports supervisor, talk to your AD. At the end of the day, your AD, whether he or she, you know, likes you, they want your track program to be successful. They don't want to have bad programs. It looks bad on them. So, you know, I find it hard to believe that ADs are you know, sabotaging their track and field program. Now, I think you have to advocate for your program at all times, but, you know, I would find it hard to believe an AD is going to sabotage their program or doesn't want to have a relationship with their track coach.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
But there's no question there. You need to have a relationship with your track coach with that, because if you don't, you're assuming with your AD, we need to have a relationship because we're coaches. But if we can do that stuff, I mean, you're more visible. You know, you do spend a lot of time sitting in our offices or out at the track at the whole time, and this be a few.
Well, in reality, I mean, you look at some of these athletic departments that have 500 employees. I mean, you think about our own situations, right? Mm-hmm. We have large track teams, and as a head coach, it doesn't do me any good to ignore maybe the worst kid on my team. Like, I still have to talk to that person. I still have to have a relationship. They're part of my team, and I brought them in. And so, you know, now I'm sure that kid probably looks at me like, oh, he doesn't care about me. But that's, you know, that's their perspective. And I think there's a lot of times track coaches have that perspective of their AD. Well, he or she doesn't care about me. It's like, well, no, you know, it's a two-way street, you know, and a lot of times I think track coaches, we're not so good at giving on our end. But again, I hate blaming us, but, you know, I always, you know, think it's easier to start with yourself and put yourself out there than the other way around.
And a lot of things, we've never done ourselves a lot of favors. One of the things is, I think at the convention, where you mentioned the self, that, you know, we don't do ourselves a lot of those things. We're talking about how big is a starting line supposed to be and how big is that Nike swoosh supposed to be here so I don't get in trouble. The Under Armour logo is supposed to be, you know, that kind of stuff. One thing we've talked a lot about is how do we help out ourselves at coaches at the convention? What do we do? One thing I know this group has talked about before, not even on the podcast, but just as one-on-ones and meetings at the convention. And this is how this whole podcast got stirred. You know, getting representation from legally, I think a lot of us would pay a nominal fee, not something astronomical that we can't afford. Mm-hmm. Track coaches, you know, this would none of us make a lot of money for what we do. Mm-hmm. But what are things in your mind that, you know, presidency is right here. That's yours next, 3 years. What do we do? How can we change the convention? What conversations can we have at the convention to say, hey, this is going to help us move forward? Because guess what? We don't – the 200 meters is 200 meters. It's not 201. It's not 199. It's 200. Cross country, we can take a clock away from cross country, and we'd still have this. Honestly, we'd be just fine. Just get rid of the damn clock because there's no point in having that thing. Mm-hmm. The distance doesn't matter. So, but what are conversations that we can help ourselves, us, professionally forward? Not just a sport, but professionally forward, because a lot of us are stuck again in our office.
Yeah, you know the you know, I guess that's the conundrum wrapped in a riddle, wrapped in an enigma, I guess you'd say. And because the hard part about the sport is it's really not just one sport; it's like six sports, you know.
Right.
And so the interests of one component of the sport oftentimes competes directly with the interest of another. And if you ever get to a point where you really start to kind of distill it a little bit or try to distill it down to something different, and that means you're going to have to, you know, probably eliminate some parts of it, you know, to make the whole a bit better. You know, and I, even to the point where like last year, you know, and I've been saying this for a couple years, like cross country should be a head count sport. I'm sorry. If you're going to ask a kid to come in August and probably run, if they're good enough, run until June, they should be on a full scholarship. They should be on a scholarship just like any, just like a team sport athlete. And plus, cross country is a quote a team sport. You have a defined number of players, and they have to stay in their role and they have to do their part for the team to win. So cross should be a team sport. What do we do? We're trying to add some scholarships and make cross country a head count sport, and we voted it down. How stupid! I mean, it's stupid. Yep. You know, well, some people will have to have much more of an opportunity than others. Well, that's just the way it is because they already have that opportunity, right? You know, and so the process of trying to give more opportunity to kids who actually deserve it, you know, we decided, nobody can have it. Mm-hmm. That's stupid. That's just dumb. I couldn't believe it. I'm sitting there, I'm like, I cannot believe it, dumbass.
Well, then we get caught up talking about, well, how's that count for track? And what if this person is a 800 meter runner on the track and they want to run cross country and they're, you know what I'm saying? That's where that conversation goes.
That's
to,
where it went.
Which is
that's
what you're kind of alluding to before. What are we talking about this? What are you talking about? We're trying to get more opportunity, more money for more people. And you're concerned because somebody, we can't figure out how the miler is going to count.
By the way, and we're trying to do that on the spot. You know, because to me, the spot, if you say, so you're telling me that I can give my cross-country team, everybody on my cross-country team, a full scholarship, and I have five, and then, hey, maybe, you know what? Hey, because that guy, that program has, you know, five or six scholarships, and it's actually a head count sport now. You know, maybe like the head cross country coach is a real head coach now, you know, and so then they can kind of get head coach benefits and head coach privileges. Now, I mean, it's a no brainer. I'm serious. It's a no brainer. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, we voted that down. You know why we voted it down? We voted it down because somebody uses 12.6 for cross country. That's why we voted it down. Mm. Right. So if you want to talk about who's selfish,
we also voted down a little bit, I would say, because of the fact that we get scared of a bigger school like an SEC where this kind of stem, this whole thing came from the SEC saying, hey, we can do this and afford this, but we cannot. Like UAB cannot afford to put six scholarships into it unless you take away six from track and field. So then we get scared with that kind of stuff, too.
That's a viable argument, but at the same time, there are already people out there who have two, three, zero. You know, so to me, to allow that situation to persist is what's killing us because we haven't held that situation accountable.
We have a lot of loose ends. It's like, we got to take care of this, but we don't care that, but we want to take care of this, but we're not going to take care of that.
So here's the thing though. Now, if you have a cross country team, right? And somehow the rules change that cross country is a head count sport, and they're supposed to have six scholarships. Don't you think you can argue that? And you might not win the argument the first time. You might not win it the second time. You might not win it the third time. But I don't know a single head count program that isn't fully funded.
Yeah,
I don't know a single one. You know, tell me your volleyball team's fully funded, right? Your basketball team's fully funded, right? So is your football team. So every other head count sport is fully funded. You know, so if it may affect a track and field in the short term, in the long term, you fully fund that, and then you can fight for, hey, now we add a scholarship this year, add a scholarship that year. Heck, I mean, if you're not fully funded, you're not really in the game anyway. You're on a treadmill. You're just trying to keep going. You know, actually, not even on the treadmill. You're on the little circle, the little hamster wheel. You're on the hamster wheel. You know, and so you keep it going because that's where you are. Yeah. But why keep others on the hamster wheel? Because you are. To me, that was one of the more egregious things that I've seen happen, and one of the more selfish things that I've seen happen as a coaching body. It really pissed me off.
Mm-hmm. You know, I just go back and forth, and it's like, you know, track coaches, we're our own worst enemies. And, you know, if we could ever get to a point where, you know, recommendations go on to the NCAA and, you know, you have, you know, one that you may be for, one for against, and just let them decide, you know, what's in the best interest of our student athletes, because we actually have track coaches that are hindering the students that we're, you know, supposedly serving, you know? So it's crazy to go to the convention and just kind of see the back and forth. And it's just like, we never get anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I mean, I don't know. I'm still trying to learn my way around the whole presence thing. But you know, who knows what's going to happen as far as a convention this year? You know, but I'll tell you, this position has been more of a ceremonial position.
Yeah.
And I don't intend to be ceremonial. So
I'd appreciate it.
So don't be surprised, you know, that if we do get into one of those meetings that it's going to be a little, I'm hoping I can be a little different than, and this is no disrespect to any of my predecessors, you know, a little different than what we've had in the past. And I also think, I don't feel like I'm tooting my own horn and overstep my bounds at all. No, but we've had a couple of our board meetings and I've asked some questions that I think other presidents haven't asked. And I was like, hey, nobody asked that question. What? Seems to me like we should. That's a really logical question. You know, like, you know, what's our budget? How do we do this? How do we do that? I've asked those questions. Like, whoa. And Sam and I, we have a great relationship. You know, it's not disrespectful or anything like that. But Sam said to me that he is quite sure that I will challenge them in ways they hadn't been challenged. And I said, oh, shit, I guess I better get to work.
So. You're right, but that's a good thing. Whether you take over a program, whether you try and change things, mm-hmm. whether you're the starting line and you're going to get challenged because you know who's right next to you, you mm-hmm. want to change things because status quo is just death on a stick. It's not living at all. Mm-hmm. And it does move us forward as people, but it doesn't move us forward mm-hmm. as a sport. And so honestly, I welcome the change. I mean, I sat mm-hmm. down. I remember sitting in it and I was actually watching you because I'm in the mid, you know, the quote unquote, I'm in the group of five, quote unquote group mm-hmm. of five. And mm-hmm. I was watching you talk about the fact of like, we need to do stuff for our sport. But then I brought all three of us together in that big massive meeting and have the independent 22 or the super 22 or the quote unquote, everybody left. Yeah. The other 22, we don't know what to call you. But mm-hmm. the power is sitting over there going, yeah, we're the powers going, could we unite as a whole, mm-hmm. at least make the sport better instead of, hey, what's best for Alabama? What's best mm-hmm. for St. Louis, what's best for Nevada, what's best for Wisconsin? Making the sport better is what it's supposed to be. And I firmly believe, like, I'm excited to have you as a president because I feel like we need to move the sport forward. We're just, mm-hmm. we're treading water. The convention's a little bit more of a party than it is things actually getting done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I think that's actually a bit of a problem that we have, that we've come to this notion, and even the quote-unquote Power Five guys, yep. you know, they're like, we come here, we never get anything done.
Dude, so then they hold their own secret.
Well, no. You're supposed to do that before you get to the convention. You know, yes. That's, you know, you come here, you think you're actually going to do something in 2 days? Come on, man. Like, you know, you got to start working and lobbying and working and kind of doing some of these things that need to be done to get something accomplished at the convention before you get to the convention. You know, yep. you can't, and all of us are guilty of it. You know, did you read your coaches association email? You know, did you read that? Did you read the annual report? Did you look at the minutes? Did you do what needed to be done? I've done it. I'm not going to lie. You know, I've gone to the convention. Man, I don't know where we're going for, but I know one thing. They serve a lot of beer. So, I mean, we've all done it. But, I mean, and that's the charge I think we all need to take that charge that we got to prepare ourselves to do something at the convention. And that requires us to do some work. But here's the thing. our sports got us so damn busy, you know, that we don't have much time to do that. But if we're going to make some changes, we're going to have to make some sacrifices. Something's going to have to give.
I was going to say, Leroy, what's kind of what's on, if you had like one or two bullet points for your, kind of your agenda as president, what's the first thing? What's the first thing you want to get done?
You know, I want to revisit if the powers that be, and it's probably emanating from the SEC, but if the powers that be want to change the scholarship structure in the sport, I really think that's something that needs to happen. And I know that is it's a scary thing right now, you know, given the COVID situation, the current environment the current economic environment that we're in. But there's too much money in athletics for us to rely on or expect kids to pay to be a part of our programs. You know, and I mean, we're probably going to have that anyway, because we're always going to have walk-on kids and stuff like that. But we got to, if I could eliminate the equivalency scholarship, I would. There should be no place in collegiate sport for equivalency scholarship. You should either be on full scholarship, we're paying for it all, or you've chosen to do it because you love it. You know, and so that's going to be a really difficult thing to do given the current environment. But here's the problem. You know, and this is a story that I think needs to be told. But for years, equivalency sports basically exploited, poor kids. Because for years, if you were on the Pell Grant, you couldn't receive your full Pell Grant. Part of your Pell Grant went to pay your scholarship. You know, and then you got $1,000. You know, that's exploitation, right? Actually, that's what happened to me. I'm like, man, I get the check. I'm like, well, wait a minute, we had to reduce your scholarship. So, that's a pretty ugly story, you know.
Yeah.
But we don't have a platform for that story to be for people to find out about it. But that's what happens, and any really good program, you know, that has tons of talent, has a lot of kids that are paying a lot of their way to be there, you know? And really, the better you are, the more good kids are paying their way, including my program, you know?
Yeah.
I tell people all the time, I said, I'm not in the business of giving away scholarships because that's not a good economic decision.
No, not at all.
And you gotta be really damn good to get a full scholarship in my program, you know, especially on the men's side. That's if you're trying to compete with the likes of, you know, the people who win the trophies, that's what you have to do. You know, I mean, I've heard a prominent coach say, well, you know what? I don't scholarship the 800. So if you're in my program, so if you're you come in, you can be 149, you can be 148, you can come in and run 146, but you're not going to get a scholarship because that's not what we do. I'm like, wow.
Wow.
But they win, you know, and it's a decision that's made, you know, to build the program the way they feel they need to build it so they can win. Well, I can understand that if there is a defined limit to the number of scholarships and everybody is under that limit and everybody who's out there competing has the same, is either on all or nothing, like in football, you know. So I just believe I firmly, one of the things we need to do is break off for now, some of the track scholarship, define that for cross country. And then I think that'll lead to bringing the rest of the sport to the head count side. And I think administrators have a lot more respect for the fact that if you're making the decision to give somebody, it's all or nothing. Like if I tell my AD, like we signed a kid from South Africa who ran 10:03 and 2060, 2059 or something like that. And we gave him full scholarship, 2-year scholarship. First time ever. We've never given a multi-year scholarship here at the University of Houston. And like the AD wants to know about him. I was like, oh, so how's he doing? Is everything? Can you get here? How's he doing? Oh, when he gets here, introduce me to him. Well, you know why? Because we paid him, because we guaranteed $120,000. We guaranteed him $120,000. Yeah, of course you want to know. You know, so if we're guaranteeing a lot of money for kids, I do think administrators will take us more seriously.
I know that for a fact. My AD is the exact same way. I have a few kids on full scholarships, and he knows them by first name, middle name, last name. May not know anybody else on the team, but he knows those kids.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So where do you – so we're in an unbelievable climate, so it's hard to predict what we have going on. You know, but best guess, what's your thought on the next couple of years for cross country and track? Which way is this going to go? Any ideas? Any thoughts? How would you like it to say? I mean, maybe you just answered that question already as well, to go to Headcount Sports, which I agree. I understand the logic. I follow it. I do like it. But what way do you think we're going to go?
I think until we can get to a point where the programs that really hang their hat on cross country, right, by using more scholarships than everybody who only has cross country.
Yep.
Until we can overcome that, we're going to have a really hard time fighting that battle. You know, because, you know, and I don't want to seem like I'm singling out anybody, because I don't know what everybody does. But, you know, until, I don't know, Northern Arizona or University of Oklahoma State, or, you know, any of the big time cross powers, you know, yep. I mean, North Carolina, with, I guess, North Carolina women are looking like they're heading in that direction.
Furman, Iona,
New Mexico, Iona, anybody on the East Coast, you know, for the most part, you know, until we get to a point where you cannot use 12 scholarships to try to, you know, produce a cross country championship, we're gonna have a hard time, you know, fighting that battle. Because everybody's going to say, well, no, you're going to make us that we choose to do it. That the argument's all, well, that's how what we choose to do. Well, you know, it's like to me, and to use a kind of you know, like a modern day comparison, like cheating on your taxes. you get all the benefit of all these scholarships, whereas everybody else is trying to run a full program, right? You know, they're trying to actually have do something in the spring in an event other than the 1500 up. So they're fighting a completely different battle. You know.
Well, that goes back, and I know I said this a couple episodes ago. It's mm-hmm. kind of a structural problem that we find ourselves in our sport within the NCAA. You know, with some of the bylaws of calling us an individual sport, when clearly cross country is a team sport. There's no getting around it. It's a team sport. There's a team score. It's, you know, I understand there's an individual component, but it's clearly a team sport. It needs to be defined as a team sport.
Absolutely.
And one other thing that, and we haven't, I don't think we've really talked too terribly much on this in our episodes about this, but I had a conversation probably about, I don't know, 8 months ago with our baseball coach. And I was asking him, you know, the value of the roster cap. What has that done to college baseball? And he said, it's one of the best things they've ever done. And the parity amongst college baseball is at an all-time high because of a roster limit. Now, you know, if all of a sudden you had a roster limit on cross country of, I don't know, 12 guys, 12 women, whatever the number is, I think you're going to, you know, all of a sudden you don't need, you know, numbers 13 through 25 on any type of scholarship aid. Mm-hmm. Now, I guess that does kind of lead into your, you know, the idea of a headcount sport, but at least it's a step in that right, you know, in that direction. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden you're limited now to having 12 cross country runners. Well, you're not going to spend money on 13 through 18 now. You got to go mm-hmm. get a 100-meter guy or, you know, hurdler or jumper of some sort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I like I said, you know, I might have to really do the editing on this myself, you know, but because I don't want to feel like I'm attacking cross country.
I don't think you are at all. Yeah, no.
Well, but because a lot of people, a good 10,000 meter race is intriguing, you know, but a sucky one's not at all. You know? And well, good steeple race is intriguing. You know, the drama of the whole thing is, it can be amazing. A great competitive cross country meet where you kind of all the strategy and all that, that's wonderful. And it should be a head count sport. I mean, there's no reason, I don't know how the hell we even got to that point, you know, that we allowed this to happen. And whoever the hell came up with the idea to count us as three and have one staff work, it's the biggest ripoff in sport, you ask me. As a matter of fact, I was sitting in a head coaches meeting with, yep, with Tom Herman. Tom Herman was our head coach. He's now the head football coach at the University of Texas. And we're sitting in a head coaches meeting, and he's like, and they're talking about the sports and our 14 sports, and he does this. He went,
it's just counting.
He's like, how come there are 14 coaches here? Oh, we count track as six. He busted out laughing. He's like, oh, what the? Oh, and I mean, he has a sale, you know, he cusses like sale. He's like, what the fuck is that? I've never heard any shit like that before. And I was like, whoa. I'm significantly, I mean, I didn't create that problem. I'm just living with it. But that's what has happened. And now I got to worry a little bit about, maybe I'll ban myself from Let's Run for about a month, because I know they're going to rip me too. So, I think we have a wonderful, amazing sport, and we have a wonderful, amazing athletes, but we screw up a whole lot of good opportunities by not being cohesive and coherent and understanding what it takes to make us relevant, right? You know, I think we missed a great opportunity, and I told Mike Holloway this. You know, about 6 years ago or so, when all of the student athlete welfare issues started coming to play, and all, yep, that. You know what kicked that whole thing off?
UConn basketball player
Kemba Walker. At the Final Four here in Houston, at the press conference, said, I go to bed sometimes and I don't have enough food to eat. That, yes, changed the game.
Yes.
Why hasn't there been a relevant, you know, media savvy track and field athlete that has used the platform that he may have or she may have, having won a championship, to talk about what's wrong with the sport? You know why? The coach didn't tell him to. No, the coach didn't tell him to, right? And I promise you, if we had won a national championship, Cameron Burrell would have spouted off.
Yeah.
You know, but I think now, I mean, it's a great point, Leroy, and I think now and just with everything that's going on in our country, this really, I mean, it's been going on for decades, right? But really this summer has been just a hot, you know, flashpoint. I think you're going to see, or at least I'd like to believe this, you're going to see a lot of kids use the platform that they have, mm-hmm, speak out about a lot of different issues, right? And I think that's, you know, to empower all of our kids, because I think we all have smart kids. We all have good kids. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just the nature of our sport, track and field and cross country, that we've got some really just kids that really know what they're talking about. And so I think you're going to see that a lot more. At least I hope so. I talk to my kids. I talk to my kids all the time about it. Mm-hmm. Hey, you have a platform. You have a voice. You have a lot of power. Use it.
Hope so, because we blew it. What track and field athletes got more publicity over the past 2 years than anyone? And I love him to death. Grant Holloway's got Grant Holloway. He was the guy. He could have done, yep, it. I told Mouse this. He was the guy, man. If Grant had said, you know what the deal is here? Don't you think Grant Holloway would have been able to, and he was articulate, and everybody loves him, and he's funny, you know, God, we just blew it. I told Mouse that a couple of weeks ago. I said, man, Mouse, we blew that one. Yeah. But, you know, and now we got to find the next guy. And here, the problem I think we have now is that, you know, we've been away for a year. No, so who's the guy?
Yeah.
Who's the girl? We don't have one yet. We don't have one right now. And this might take 2 years for that to happen.
No, we've got a few at the professional level, but you're right. Let the kids right now be advocates. I know Allie Ostrander did some stuff after a couple of years ago when she was at Texas, and the announcers made some, we'll just say mistakes in the way that they were calling the race and describing females and that kind of stuff. That was an issue as well. I know my girls have done here at UAB, my girls have started to reach out a little bit and say, hey, we need more publicity, or we need more XYZ going on. And they've been very loud about it, especially in fact of a lot of programs, a lot of conferences have sat down and said, we're just going to take our time on cross country. American Conference is a perfect example. Hey, we're not going to announce if we have cross country or not. Conference still actually hasn't made a definitive announcement, even though the coach has been told we have a championship. Mm-hmm. As well, we have a championship. So it's awesome. But the press releases and things that were way being treated need to be addressed. Mm-hmm. 100% agree with that. No questions about that. Mm-hmm. Leroy, I hate to even stop this conversation because I think this is one of the great conversations we've had in a very, very long time. I think this is one of those things that us as coaches need to sit down and talk about. We need to reevaluate things. We need to figure it out. And you brought up a point without bringing up a point. It's not what's best for the University of Houston. It's not what's best for UAB. It's not what's best for anybody on this team, even the Indiana University, because of the, being in the Big Ten. It's what's best for the sport and how can we move the sport forward. And that's something that you're very, very passionate about and very much, an advocate for. And, we'll stand right behind you with the presence and say, hey, let's go. What can we do? I love the idea of a head count sport because it makes sense. The more you explain it, it makes sense to me. So, but truly appreciate you being on the call tonight. And thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. We got a lot of work to do. I don't have all the answers, and nope. I'm definitely not the smartest guy in the room. But I care about everything I have. Mm-hmm. I got through this sport, and it just pains me to see opportunities being taken away. So we can pay another salary in the football or basketball office, because that's basically what it amounts to.
No, I agree with you 100% right there. The sport that's given you so much, given us so much, allows us to live and allows us to be able to have a house and a roof overhead, food on the table. It's something that we need to care deeply about. Ladies and gentlemen, in general, I want to thank you guys for spending time of your day, time of your walk, time of your run, whatever the case might be, listening to us. We know you have a lot of choices of podcasts. Hopefully we're one of the few that you have zoned in to listen to. Hopefully we bring great conversation. That's what this podcast was originally about, was to bring great, true coaches conversation to everybody else. Because these are conversations that we all have at the back of the convention, at the back with our friends, wherever the case might be, we have conversations like this. Hopefully you guys got some value out of it. If you did, please like us on iTunes, write us a review, Spotify, go ahead and share us. If you're on any other platforms, Anchor as well, please write a review, share us. Word of mouth is without question the best form of advertisement and communication in general. So tell your friends, hey, let's sit and listen to this podcast. It's well worth every single minute of it. No questions about that. But we will try and do better next week. We look forward to having you. Thank you, everybody. It was great seeing you.
Thanks, Leroy.